You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Martin Lee, and this is the Autosport Podcast. Welcome back to the next episode in our mini-series looking at the top 10s, and today another top 10 to enjoy. But if you liked our first series entirely put together by our chief editor Kevin Turner, maybe you like the twist we've given this series where our editors are choosing their own top 10s, and Kev gets to be pundit, for want of a better word. Today we're looking at the top 10 Minardi Formula One drivers. The team today known as AlphaTauri started life as Minardi, an underdog run on a fraction of the budget of its rivals. Now, Minardi will shortly be usurped by Red Bull for ninth in the list of World Championship F1 starts, but that is indeed an indication of how many starts they did have. And you may be surprised about how many drivers' names you recognise on our top 10 list today. Let's get into it with the person that put this list together, and that is James Newbold. So, why Minardi and why this list?
Hi, Martin. You could argue that Minardi is the little team that everyone loved back in the day. It was Italy's other team, so Ferrari was winning everything, but there was also this plucky underdog outfit that was scrabbling with often outdated engines, and usually the chassis were actually pretty good, but the engines held them back. They had this brilliant knack of finding young talents that would go on to brighter and better things. All in all, there were 37 drivers that came through Minardi. Not all of them were of the highest calibre, but a great deal of them were really good drivers that were picked absolutely on merit for their abilities, which is always something to be admired in my view.
And Kevin, you get to critique this list. Are you looking forward to this one?
Yeah, it's a different role, isn't it? With the Arrows one, Jake Boxall legs stepped up, and James is what I would call the other king of mediocrity in the sense that he also enjoys a hopeless F1 car. The lower level teams are actually harder to do the lists on. So I needed some help. So so for this series, we've divvied it up a little bit. I've done three, and we've had a guest list writer for the other three. And I thought Minardi seemed to, it's a feel good team. It's a nice little story. Lots of starts. Quite looking forward to this one. It'd be a little bit different, but as you say, there'll be some big names further up the list.
Some F1 winners, world champion in there. And I think a name as well that, you know, any fan of Formula One for a while will think of one particular name as synonymous with Minardi, but we'll see where that person ranks on the list. But let's get into it then. And we are going to have a few drivers here that are on your list, James, that didn't actually score points. But there's a good reason for that, because, you know, they've made the top 10, but they weren't actually point scorers. But we are talking about Minardi here. Let's start at number 10 with Justin Wilson. Now, Justin Wilson started for 11 times with Minardi, didn't score any points. Best finish was 11th in the 2003 Spanish Grand Prix. Best grid position was 18th. Now, why did you put Justin Wilson in the list? And as Kev has often said in these features, number 10 is very hard because it's who you leave out as well. Who's at, you know, 11 and 12. But talk us through your reasoning for Justin Wilson.
Quite, yeah. I mean, Justin Wilson, he's here primarily because of his opening lap records. He was absolutely fantastic on opening laps at making up positions. And although he was out-qualified over the course of his time at the team by Jos Verstappen, actually, Paul Stoddart was quoted as saying that was the best lineup that Minardi had ever had. Jos Verstappen, you could argue a journeyman Formula One driver, but when he arrived on the scene in 1994, it was off the back of blitzing the German F3 championship. We'll go on to talk about Jos Verstappen a little bit more later, but you know, it was no shame that Wilson was out-qualified by Verstappen, who clocked up 100 Grand Prix, his 100th Grand Prix start during his time at the team. Just a sensational opening lap driver. And Australia and Malaysia and the Spanish Grand Prix, he made up 9 positions. A remarkable, you know, you could say that starting at the back of the grid, you can only go one way. But Wilson was one of those drivers that could spot an opportunity and really take it and put a Minardi in positions it wasn't supposed to be in.
And what was the machinery like that he had to work with in his era at Minardi?
I mean, the 2003 car was pretty much an updated version of the 2001 car, a customer Ford engine, so really not at the zenith of the team's competitiveness. You have to look towards the sort of the early 90s and the late 80s for that. It had sort of its slide down towards the back of the grid, from which it wouldn't really recover. It had been well underway for a few years by that point. But Wilson did enough during his time to earn a mid-season promotion to Jaguar in place of Antonio Pizzonia, and he actually gained the most opening lap positions of anyone throughout the whole season, despite spending, you know, much of the second half of the season in sort of mid-grid machinery that meant, you know, that the opportunities to pick off some of the less attentive drivers, shall we say, were reduced. Wilson didn't score any points, and this is probably a point that we should mention at the start, is there are drivers who scored points for Minardi who we haven't included on this list. That's because a lot of the decision making for who made the 10 was based, one, on qualifying, but also what they did relative to their teammates. So a driver who scored points in a one-off sort of freak race, but who the vast majority of the time was out-qualified by their teammate, or in some cases didn't even make the cut for the race, I don't think can really be considered as part of the 10 strongest on the basis of one result. While Wilson didn't score points, you can consistently say that his race craft was really good, and the benchmark that was his teammate in Verstappen was a very good one. So although he was only ahead of the Dutchman 4 times out of 7, and again it's a small sample size, but I don't think you can say that he could have done a whole lot more with the machinery that he had. It wasn't like he was, you know, drastically slower or anything.
And for any of our listeners that haven't heard any of the previous of the, you know, in either mini-series we've done, you know, this is worth reminding. We are judging the drivers on their time they spent with this team. And because, in case you're thinking, well, hang on, he went on to have a fabulous career, and obviously tragically in Indy, but a great driver, we always judge them on the time they spent with the team you know, apologies if you knew that already. Kev, your thoughts on putting Justin Wilson in 10th?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think it's probably also worth mentioning that he was taller than you'd really ideally want as a Formula One driver. So he always had that, you know, getting him to be in the car. And his head always looked much closer to the top of the air intake as well. I always thought that was surely created some kind of aerodynamic disturbance that wasn't ideal. And, of course, he was a lot less experienced than Verstappen as well when they were together. So, no, I absolutely think he did a good job. I guess we're going to talk about who didn't make the list like in this 10 slot. I think the only person who might really be considered high. Well, there's two names I thought of. One was Luis Perez Sala, but then when you look at how he compared to Pierluigi Martini, he was completely and utterly blown apart. So I think he was a point scorer, but I think it's fair enough not to have him in the list. But I think perhaps more hard done by is perhaps Pedro Lamy, who is a better driver than he probably gets credit for these days. But as with these, always with these lists, if you're putting someone in, who do you take out? And looking down the list, I'm not convinced that there's anyone that I would remove to get Pedro in there. But I think he deserves a sort of honourable mention, really.
Absolutely. And with Pedro Lamy, the main reason that I didn't include him was because of someone that we'll talk about later during their team head-to-head, where Lamy did impress against one of his Minardi teammates, but then was beaten quite comprehensively by the other. So we'll go on to talk about that a little bit later. But absolutely, Lamy is the record, equal record holder of the number of Nürburgring 24-hour wins with five. So a very distinguished driver who just didn't show that quite in Formula One.
All right, let's move on. In ninth place, you put Alessandro Nannini. Started 30 times, didn't score any points, did finish 11th. Best starting position on the grid was 13th. What's your reasoning for him, James?
Nannini is pretty much setting the mould for what the archetypal Minardi driver should be, because he was a driver who was young, took a punt on by Giancarlo Minardi, the team owner. In this instance, they'd actually worked together before in Formula 2. And Nannini arrives in Formula 1 for 1986, which is the second year for Minardi in Grand Prix racing as they step up to a two-car team. Woefully unreliable, Moderni V6 engine turbos really kind of stymied what Nannini could do. But actually, when you look at what he did in comparison with Andrea De Cesaris, who is his significantly more experienced teammate, Nannini really doesn't disgrace himself at all. And it's that I think brings him onto the list, because the sheer unreliability means that actually judging his race results is really rather difficult. But he was eight all against De Cesaris, which is no mean feat, and he outqualified De Cesaris several times in a row later in the season as he sort of gained experience, including occasionally in the older 85 updated car, when De Cesaris usually had the pick of the newer 86 car. Then in 87 he wiped the floor with Adrian Campos and was never headed in qualifying, so he got his promotion to Benetton off the back of that and became an F1 winner. So on that basis, you can say that that's what Minardi was all about. It was giving opportunities to drivers that could show what they could do in lesser machinery and mark them out as future stars.
And that teammate comparison is a useful one, because it's same, you know, most of the time identical machinery as best as they can get. And so you can judge them against other drivers as well when putting these lists together. Kev, what are your thoughts?
I've been humming and hawing about whether this driver should actually be one spot higher. One of the things I was looking at is if you look at Nannini versus the next person on our list, he's got a better teammate record in qualifying. So you could use that to swap them around, but then the next person on our list has one particular moment that just from a sympathy point of view means he should probably get a bonus extra position. So I'm pretty pretty comfortable with Nannini, but I just want to pull out one of the stats that James did for his piece. Bearing in mind that he started 30 World Championship races for Minardi, he only saw the finish four times. Now, I think for a modern F1 fan that perhaps wasn't around in the explosive turbo days of cars littering the track on either side of the road, that seems astonishing. But I think even by the standards of the 1980s, four finishes out of 30, I mean, cool, you'd have to have some real patience with your team, I think. So yeah, no, I'm happy with Nannini in ninth. I think you could swap 9 and 8 around and around and keep going, but happy with the positions that they're in.
Well, let's get into number 8. It's Luca Badoa. Started a couple more races, 32 starts, again no points, but did finish 8th, so not far off the points. Also started up in 12th. James, do you buy that argument that Luca Badoa and Alessandro Nannini sort of a little bit interchangeable, or do you think he's got a good shout of being one? What, well, you must do because you put the list together, one place higher.
I mean, Kev's absolutely right in terms of his qualifying record. Nannini's is better than Badoa's. Badoa had two spells at Minardi. He joined in 1995. He'd spent a year on the sidelines in 94 as a test driver, and so kind of was shaking off a bit of rust when he started the season alongside Pierluigi Martini, who we'll go on to talk about much more later on. Didn't embarrass himself at all against Martini, and as you mentioned, had some good qualifying results early in the year. And I discovered in researching for this that he actually crossed the line 7th at the 95 Canadian Grand Prix, but the result was taken back a lap because there was a track invasion following Jean Alesi's win in the number 27 Ferrari, of course the Gilles Villeneuve number on the circuit named after him. So it was deemed that that was unfair that he'd overtaken Mikasalo amidst crowds of fans teaming onto the track, so he was docked a place. But he then joins 40 for a hopeless season and then tests for Ferrari for a couple of years before returning to the grid in 99. He's up against Marc Genet, and he does well against Genet. I forgot to mention actually that he was out qualified by Pedro Lamy towards the end of 95 when Martini steps out and Lamy makes his F1 comeback after his leg breaking test crash at Silverstone for Lotus in 94. Badoa, yeah, he's so unfortunate. I mean, the 1999 European Grand Prix is one that a lot of people kind of pick out as a race of what could have been for multiple different drivers, but for Badoa, who never scored a point in his Formula One career, and it's kind of tainted really by his substitute appearances for Felipe Massa in 2009 after a decade without racing. But he'd be painted in such a different light had his gearbox not failed when he was running fourth in the closing laps at the Nürburgring. Just as Kev mentioned earlier, you know, terribly unfortunate, and you know he broke down in tears by the side of his car at the roadside. So Badoa does sort of on sympathy deserve a place in this top 10, because fourth place would have been equaling the very best result ever attained by Minardi. And to add insult to injury, his teammate Marc Genet stole in and nabbed the only point of the year for the team in sixth place, which was just a double hammer blow, really. So Badoa, not the best record against his teammates in qualifying, but a good strong racer who arguably probably shouldn't have been in the Minardi for that European Grand Prix, because perhaps you could argue he should have been the one that Ferrari chose instead of Mikasalo when Schumacher had his leg-breaking shunt at Silverstone. And then, you know, Badoa racing in his prime, would he have done a better job than Salo? It's difficult to say, but he certainly wouldn't have ended his F1 career without a single point to his name and a subject of mockery, really.
Yeah, I think that I know we try and be more objective with these lists, but it's hard to get away from the emotional thing with Badoa, not just because of that, you know, the sort of helmet in the hand, sort of crying there by the side of the road. You know, I think everyone... you think you have to be pretty cold-hearted not to have felt for him at that moment. But also because I'm pleased that he's in the list, because I think he's kind of remembered for those couple of Ferrari outings in 2009, which is incredibly unfair, really. I mean, I think he probably will hold the record for the worst Autosport driver rating ever. I think one of those races he got half a point, which I can't see Matt Kiel, Alex Kalinauskas being that harsh on any of the current grid to give such something so low. But that car was actually very, very difficult to drive. Kimi Raikkonen and Felipe Massa struggled with it at various points during that year. And Fisichella didn't exactly set the world alight when he got in it either. So I think that Badoa probably is a bit hard done by there. So yeah, no, very, very happy to see him on the list at 8. I think that's fair enough.
Well, look at you two giving the sympathy vote to the Italian that was denied.
I know, it's terrible. Isn't it?
Well, you know, the emotions are coming into it. Let's move on and let's get into place number 7 now. Giancarlo Fisichella started only 8 times and scored no points, but finished well in 8th. As his highest position, and at the same race, Canadian Grand Prix in 96, started 16th, his best grid position. So, less of an outing for the team, but making a higher ranking. James, Giancarlo Fisichella in 7th.
He's a rookie in 96 when he gets his opportunity with Minardi. He won the Italian F3 Championship in 94, which kind of marked him out as a future star. But he'd been racing touring cars for Alfa Romeo in 95, and he was actually slated to carry on doing touring cars for 96 and ended up swapping between the two. So a pretty good effort, really, given that he... He was swapping backwards and forwards between two very different types of cars as a rookie, and he wasn't really supposed to be doing the 96 season. He was a late call-up to replace Taki Inoue, who didn't set the world alight, it's fair to say, with footwork in 95. Inoue's money fell through, so Fisichella was given the chance, and at short notice he came in alongside Lamy, who had done better than Badoa in the end of 95. And Fisichella confidently, you know, had Lamy covered in their 8 races together. He beat him 6-2 in qualifying, which is a 75% record, which is one of the best totals that in a head-to-head that any Minardi driver had. He didn't do all the races. Obviously, he stepped out for the 2 South American races so that Tarso Marquez could have a go. And he didn't see out the season either when he got back in the car, because Giovanni Lavaggi, who is you could arguably say Formula One's last gentleman driver, saw out the season in his car. But he did a really good job given his lack of experience. And I think, you know, it's that factor and jumping in between two different cars and going up against a teammate in Lamy, who arguably should have won the 1993 International Formula 3000 Championship. A really good driver, as we've already covered, that means Fisichella earns his spot in the list.
Yeah, Lamy, a good driver, a great racing driver over the course of his career. Not the most illustrious Formula One career, I guess you could say. But Kevin, what do you think, Giancarlo Fisichella in 7th? What's your analysis of that?
Yeah, and I fear that I promise that I will disagree with some of these choices further on in the list, because we don't want to just go through all the 10 and agree. But I think Fizzy's fairly firmly in here, because I think his performances in a handful of races probably do just about get him ahead of the 3 we've discussed already. But I think from that fewer starts, you can't really push any higher up the list. So I think he's probably pretty rooted in that. I mean, remember, I think Jenson Button described him as the best driver of rubbish car that he'd ever seen. I think Fisichella is an absolute... He's almost my archetypal go-to driver when you're talking about someone who was brilliant when the equipment was poor and got progressively worse the more competitive his car was. So when it was when he had a Grand Prix or championship winning car in the Renault, he was absolutely and completely obliterated by Fernando Alonso, who admittedly is a very tough benchmark, as many drivers have found since. But also he'd need to get radio calls to sort of wake him up in the middle of the race, and he suddenly go 3/4 of a second a lap quicker. So I've always thought he'd be an absolutely brilliant British hill climb champion, sort of championship driver, Fisichella, which you won't hear that said in many podcasts, I'm sure. But no, I think from a Minardi point of view, I think he's spot on, and he did a very good job with very little experience.
He's another one of those drivers that goes on to have a very long, you know, career, as Kev's kind of said there, and in the Nannini mould sort of thing, as, you know, underlining what Minardi was all about as well.
It's a very niche list, isn't it? Best drivers of rubbish cars that were then rubbish in good cars, because then you'd have to have people like, you know, Heinz Harald Frentzen, he'd be in there as well. You can have Frentzen, Fisichella face-off, couldn't you, in that sort of list.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
here.
As we always say, that's a podcast for another day. Now, though, I know two drivers that, Kev, you are going to disagree with on James here. So we'll look at them together. Now, James, you put Jos Verstappen in sixth place. He started 16 times for Minardi, didn't score any points, did finish ninth in the 2003 Canadian Grand Prix, also had his best grid start for the same race. He's in sixth, and you put Jarno Trulli in fifth. Now, he started fewer races for Minardi, only six starts, also a non-point scorer, finished in ninth, grid position 17th, back at Australia in 1997. So I know, Kev, you might disagree with these two. We'll look at them together, but James, argue your case for why you put Jos in sixth and Jarno in fifth.
Verstappen, we sort of covered that he went up against Justin Wilson, who was a very strong rookie, and did pretty well. Verstappen had had a year out of Formula One after he was sort of unceremoniously dumped by Arrows at the end of 2001. And he, you know, wanted to prove that he still had something to show Formula One. And I think he did that, because in machinery that was never going to be anything other than the tail ender, he didn't let his motivation get down, out-qualified Wilson, and his record arguably could have been better had he not had a few sort of mechanical problems that maybe skew the qualifying head-to-head a little bit more. Also, when Wilson comes up to Jaguar, Nicolas Chiesa comes in to replace him for the rest of the season, Verstappen wipes the floor with him. He has... His best moment is unquestionably at Manicourt, in a moment that I remember fondly, but the history books arguably don't, because it really doesn't matter in the wider context of the race weekend, where at the time the qualifying format was sort of a one-shot qualifying where it was split into two sessions. The first session would determine the running order for the qualifying session that actually set the grid. So the first session was set by championship order, and at Manicourt it rained. So all the guys that were high up in the championship were struggling around on a wet track that was gradually drying. So the guys at the bottom end of the standings had more of a chance to impress. Verstappen was ahead of Wilson in the standings, so in theory had worse conditions, but beat him there. And that is the only time in F1 history that a Minardi ever topped a session. So Verstappen has that glory moment to his name, which ultimately counted for not very much. Like Wilson, he was also caught out in the Turn 3 river at Interlagos, which is the big what-if moment, really, of his time at the team, because he'd been brimmed with fuel before the start, and had the race kind of run as it did, being red-flagged before the end after Alonso and Webber shunted. There's a very good chance that a Minardi would have been on the podium. And when he shunted, Verstappen was actually ahead of eventual winner Fisichella. So there's a big question of what if there. The reason I've put him behind Jarno Trulli, despite Trulli doing so many fewer races...
Not even a full season, like six races. So, and you still put him ahead.
Yeah, he entered seven. He didn't start one because he had a problem before the start of the race at Imola. Trulli was a rookie coming in. He'd won the German F3 championship the year before against a good teammate, Inoki Akatayama, who was very experienced. Trulli just absolutely wipes the floor with him. He's only beaten once in qualifying by Katayama, and that's on his debut. But the reason I've really put Trulli above Verstappen is because of the number of other teams that Trulli habitually managed to beat in qualifying and put between himself and Katayama. So the 97 Minardi was the slowest car of the year on Super Times, which is our sort of metric for assessing how fast a car is versus the overall pace, once we take out the Lola, which only attempted to qualify for Australia. But Trulli was never on the back row of the grid. He always out-qualified someone else from another team. Jan Magnussen Stewart, he beat five times. Verstappen in a Tyrrell, he beat four times. Mika Salo three times. Pedro Diniz, Shinji Nakano in an Arrows and a Prost, respectively. And he also beat Nicola Larini's Sauber in Brazil. So he was he did really well in the machinery that he had available to him relative to his team at Katayama. When he got promoted to Prost midway through the season when Olivier Panis broke his legs and they needed a new driver, Tarso Marquez, who'd had a couple of outings in 96, came back in, and he was outqualified by Katayama pretty comprehensively, which suggests that Trulli was really getting the most out of his machinery. And as we know from later years, Trulli was a real qualifying demon. That's really the environment he thrived in. And so on that basis, for the lack of experience relative to Verstappen and the faster cars that he outpaced in qualifying, is my reason for putting him there, despite the right. admittedly small sample size.
So his one lap pace gets him above Verstappen in your list. But Kev, I know you don't see it quite the same.
No, there are a couple of reasons why I would swap them round. I don't have a problem with James's approach to using qualifying a bit more for this than some of the other lists. I think that makes sense given the unreliability in the sort of midfield to back end in the races. So I think it's a good way of doing it. But I think the two reasons I would swap them around. One is the sample size. I think that six races versus a whole season slogging your guts out for a back end team has got to be worth something. But also about the nature of that qualifying. I would argue actually Jarno Trulli is one of the best qualifiers in F1 history. Like his qualifying efforts compared to his race, I think, were incredible. But I think if you're a midfield to back end team, what do you want? Do you want a sort of star qualifier? Do you want someone who's going to grind out a result on the when the opportunity comes along? And I think that if you're a big team like Toyota and you haven't achieved as much as you should have done, and you want to get a front row to say, yeah, look, we're quick, then Trulli's great. Stick him in and stick it on the front row and you look good. And yep, Toyota are quick, and then if he falls back to sixth in the race, it doesn't matter. I think if you're a back end team that you might get one opportunity a year to score a point, then I think I'd personally rather have the battling Jos Verstappen in my car than Trulli. I don't think Trulli was as bad in the races as people remember, actually. I think it was because he kept qualifying so far ahead of where the cars should be, really. So I completely agree with his qualifying effort. But if I'm boss of Minardi, I'm picking Jos over Jarno, I think, for trying to get that result that I really need.
Yeah, before we had the DRS train, we had the Trulli train, and that's an unfair way of remembering a very, very good
driver. He was better
driver.
Than that, yeah.
but still, right, let's move on. And in fourth place, James, you put Christian Fittipaldi. Now, had a decent number of starts for Minardi, started 24 times, and we get into the point scorers now. So now you can start to argue on world championship points about why the driver is where they are as we head towards the top three. Scored 6 points. He finished fourth as his best result and started 12th as his best grid position. Christian Fittipaldi, James.
Yes, I mean, Fittipaldi is actually the highest placed driver on the list who has a sort of, if you could use the term, iffy qualifying record. I mean, for the lower segments, I really tried to look at who definitely had the better of their teammates in qualifying and use that as the basis. But Fittipaldi, you just can't overlook his race drives. So he only has a 51.9% teammate record in the head-to-heads. Now, that's arguably skewed by, in his rookie year in 92, he had a big shunt in qualifying at Magny-Cours and hurt his neck. So he missed a few races, came back arguably too soon, and didn't qualify for a few, and then only sort of scraped onto the back end of the grid. So a lot of his 92 season was kind of blighted by that, really. He was up against a very capable teammate in Gianni Morbidelli, who was another one that I considered to make the top 10 in the list. But actually, towards the end of that season, he comes on really strong, and in Suzuka, he battles with Jean Alesi's Ferrari all the way to the flag and ends up finishing sixth. And then come 93, he starts that in a really good vein of form. So he was never headed by his teammate Fabrizio Barbazza in qualifying. Had a non-stop run to fourth in the Kyle Army season opener. And he qualified 13th there, which was the highest a Minardi would figure on the grid all year. And he took fifth at Monaco, where he beat Martin Brundle's Ligier as well to that finish. He was beaten by Martini, who has so many spells at Minardi. We'll go on to talk about a bit later when he returned towards the end of 93. And you could argue that his 93 season is kind of best remembered for their sort of coming together on the approach to the finish line at Monza, where Fittipaldi moves out to pass Martini, and he sort of ever so slightly jinks to the right, and Fittipaldi ends up somersaulting over his car, and very fortunately lands back on all four wheels again. The pictures of that are just astounding to watch. And he doesn't see out the 93 season because Jean-Marc Gounon, who another driver who'd impressed in F3000. Oh, Fittipaldi was the 91 F3000 champion. Justin Wilson was the 2001 champion, drove for Minardi. So Badoa was the 92 champion. So they did have a record of sort of promoting young talents, as we've mentioned multiple times. But Gounon had backing from the French government, who wanted to promote French sports people. So that took precedence over Fittipaldi towards the end of the season, and he was shuffled out. But I think the basis of his race performances, and also his development where he started in 92 towards the end of his time in Minardi, a really reliable point scorer who he scored 6 points for the team, which I think is the second highest of anybody else in for Minardi. And let's not forget, he was driving for the team at a period when they weren't at their competitive zenith. That had arguably kind of passed at the end of 91. So I think Fittipaldi did a really good job as Minardi was sort of beginning its descent towards the back end of the grid that it couldn't really recover from.
And he'd go on to get that footwork drive afterwards, and he'd score half of his Formula One World Championship points that he'd score in his entire career with Minardi. So, again, if you're just working on World Championship points and that progression as well, as you can say, from first season to second season, when we look forward to the top three, which we'll get to, and then you look at the ones behind him, the Trullis and Verstappens that weren't point scorers, he sort of seems to suit a natural fourth place, because you can't argue him against the top three that we're going to get to, but also he's so much better than the names that we've done so far.
Yeah, he can't possibly get into the top three debate. I mean, if you were talking about the best drivers who had ever sat in a Minardi, which is not the list that these are, then I think I'd have him ninth or tenth in this list. I think they were pretty much everyone we talked about so far I'd have on sort of basic ability, or certainly in F1 I'd put them ahead of Fittipaldi. But I think we're talking about their time at Minardi, their impact at Minardi, then yeah, I completely agree. He's got the point scores, hasn't he? He's got a decent record. He's got the longevity. You know, he's there for a bit longer than, you know, a lot of the people we've talked about so far have just got a sort of handful of starts or maybe one season. He's got longer than that. Scored a high position. But I don't think he was outstanding in a way that the top three that we'll come to talk about. So I think he's an absolute nailed on, just misses the medal placings driver.
Nailed on fourth, faint praise. But how much of his performance and how many of those points, because obviously we're giving a lot of weighting now to he was a point scorer for Minardi, how much of that, James, was on merit and talent versus, you know, drivers can pick up points when, you know, the eight drivers ahead of them all decide to trip over each other and you pick your way through the mess. So how much of that was on, you know, genuine pace and he deserves to be there, or how much of that was kind of fortune or luck?
No, I think with Fittipaldi you can say that it was earned. I mean, the Kyalami race was, you know, as I said, a non-stop race where, you know, that requires a lot of time management. Of course, Minardi is going to always benefit from attrition to have to score points. It's very rarely, unless we're talking about Pierluigi Martini's time at the team, going to be factoring at the front on sheer pace. But his race drives were really good, and I haven't listened to the Arrows podcast yet, but I hope that when Fittipaldi was discussed, mention was made to him losing a points finish or a potential podium even at Monaco in 1994. I mean, that was a track that he always went really well at. And a couple of years ago when Fittipaldi retired after a very long and distinguished career, he went on to race in Champ Car and sports cars, won 3 Daytona 24 Hours. Had a long chat with him about his career, and it was really fascinating sort of hearing him reflect on his time in Formula One. you know, he that drive at Suzuka in 92 after several races of, you know, being a subpar version of himself while his neck wasn't at full strength to press Alesi and score the team's only point of the year. And Suzuka, by the way, is obviously not a walk in the park track. That's a real driver's circuit where, you know, you look to circuits like that where drivers are doing well and say that's proper. And we Kev briefly mentioned there about the very best drivers that have ever sat in a Minardi. You could make mention there perhaps of Alex Zanardi, who was the driver that subbed for Fittipaldi in 92, but he didn't do an awful lot in his time in the 92 Minardi either, which maybe you could argue was down to lack of race fitness because he'd been out of the car for a little while. But yeah, at a point when Minardi wasn't at its peak.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Fittipaldi was a very dependable driver that led the team pretty well.
Now, I've been wondering whether to do drivers 2 and 3 together, because I know that there's going to be an argument between them. But if we do that, then it definitely gives away the number one, because I don't know what to do. Look, let's just do driver number 3, because we've mentioned one particular driver who is synonymous with Minardi, let's face it, but we'll keep the listeners hanging on just a little bit more. And in third place, you have put Mark Webber. Now, he started 17 times. He scored 2 points, best finish in 2002 with the Australian Grand Prix, qualified well there as well. And of course, there's the Australian connection as well. So you put Mark Webber in third place. And now we start to get to the you know, three drivers that our listeners will know connected with Minardi. So James, Mark Webber only in third?
Yes. So Webber made his debut, Formula One debut with Minardi in 2002. And he couldn't have dreamt that it would have gone as well as it did, where you have a multi-car pile-up at the first corner in front of him that gives him a chance at points. But what really, you know, you can say, oh, that's just down to luck, but that ignores the fact that he had to hold off Mika Salo, who was a very experienced Formula One driver, to keep hold of that fifth place. Salo eventually spins trying to pass him. And the fact that Toyota Salo's team would only score 2 sixth places and Minardi's only points were that fifth place, it meant that Minardi stayed ahead of Toyota in the World Constructor standing. So that was an absolutely enormously significant result for that season. Webber as well, he has a 100% qualifying record. He's up against Alex Jung, who was a Malaysian driver who was, shall we say, not of the same level really. Webber had been a consistent winner in FIA GTs with Mercedes. He'd been right at the front in Formula 3000. He'd been a Benetton test driver, so he was really well prepared, and he absolutely made the best use of his car, which was an admittedly a tail end car, but he was able to punch against, you know, the Arrows cars that were sort of running out of money, and he regularly sort of embarrassed the Jaguars as well, out-qualified Pedro De La Rosa and Eddie Irvine on several occasions. His zenith was arguably Manicur, where he was running ahead of both Toyotas in the race before they retired, and De La Rosa's Jaguar finished eighth. So no points back then, because points only went down to sixth. But in his autobiography, he ranks that as a drive that was equally as good as Melbourne. He also had Anthony Davidson as a teammate for 2 races. Anthony Davidson probably wasn't at his sort of peak then, shall we say. He kind of struggled with the physicality of the car and couldn't get near Webber either. So I think Webber is absolutely deserving of a high place on the list. But the reason I've put him behind the person who's in second was just because of the sheer frequency with which the second place driver was able to beat faster cars. And actually the fact that happened sort of even quite late into the season, when Minardi would normally regress to a weaker position, the second place driver could do that more frequently. But you could say Webber actually did get to stand on a podium, which was slightly unorthodox. Paul Stoddart sort of was mates with the promoters of the Australian Grand Prix and got Webber up on the podium to wave to all the fans. So that's the only time that ever happened in Formula One history.
Yeah, and you know, and a clean sweep. The only driver on this list with a clean sweep, 100% record in qualifying over his teammates. And you know, in terms of Formula One drivers these days, you know, whether it's drivers that have come through GP2 or F2 to start Formula One at a pretty young age, Mark Webber was a little bit older when he came into Formula One. Third on this list, what do you reckon?
Yeah, so it's really tight between second and third. And I think it's easy to think that the second place person probably was more relentless and got more consistent at Minardi, but that's really from a position of hindsight where we just know that his career is like that. I think if you look at some of the stats and criteria that James has pulled out, they're kind of, that, you know, they've got almost exactly the same average qualifying position. They both completely destroyed their teammates. The only reason that number two hasn't got 100% is for reasons outside of his control. So, yeah, it's really nip and tuck between the two of them. You can argue them either way, but for me, I just can't get the image of Mark Webber and Paul Stoddart on the podium in Melbourne out of my head. Like, to me, that's almost Webber's greatest moment, I think, his first race. But also, if you're a Minardi fan, that's a day you're going to remember. Like, that day, first of all, the fifth was amazing anyway, but just the, you know, the enthusiasm and the cheering and everything around that, like, that's kind of embodies what Minardi's about, right? They're going to get one moment every 2, 3, 4 years where they get that point, or they get a couple of points that you really were rooting for them to get. And okay, completely circumstances. I'm sure the second person on this list would have done exactly the same thing in that position. But the point is, it was Mark Webber who was there and who got that result. And I think it's just such a big, it was such a big day for Minardi and Minardi fans. And it's so equal across the rest of the rest of the criteria we're looking at. I would nudge him into second place, even though if I was doing a list of great Grand Prix drivers, there's absolutely no way I would be arguing to swap these two around.
Well, let's do our second place now, which are going to give away our first place. But let's argue amongst between two and three. In second place, James, you put Fernando Alonso. He didn't score any points for Minardi. He started 17 times. Yet you put him above Mark Webber. So give us your reasoning for that. And I think Kev might have an argument against it.
Well, I mean, you know, Alonso, like Webber, he's a rookie when he comes into Formula One. But Minardi is in such a worse position at the start of 2001 than it is in 2002. So it's just been taken over by Paul Stoddart, who's kind of rescued the team from certain collapse, because it was owned by Gabriele Rumi, who was he owned the Fondmetal Formula One team and the Fondmetal Wheels Company, but he had a terminal illness, so he was, you know, kind of desperate to offload this asset. There'd already been one sale to the PSN telecommunications company that had fallen through. So Stoddart sort of picks it up, and you know, this story is fairly well known, that, you know, the mechanics worked around the clock to get cars built up and shipped out to Australia. And poor old Tasso Marquez, we've mentioned him a couple of times, he comes back in to drive the second car, and it's kind of a bit of a brick, really, of whatever pieces they can pull together. So it's fair to say that Alonso probably did have the better of the two cars, but my word, does he make the best of it. I found a quote from the San Marino Grand Prix report issue where the designer Gustav Brunner is commenting on Alonso qualifying 18th ahead of both the Benetton drivers, Button and Fisichella, and he was saying, well, our car shouldn't be able to do that lap time, so I can only assume that it's from the driver. You know, with the worst car in the field, he frequently embarrasses faster machinery. So he beat both Benetton's Imola, Barcelona and the A1 ring, where he was 18th each time. He also out-qualified both Arrows, so Verstappen and Enrico Bernoldi in Monaco, Hungary and Suzuka. He'd often beat a Jaguar and a Prost as well. At the US Grand Prix, he was 17th, and that's, you know, right towards the end of the season. And he out-qualified Jacques Villeneuve's BAR, which I just find absolutely astounding. As Kev sort of mentioned, you know, he only lost his 100% qualifying record to sort of factors outside of his control. So there was a gearbox problem in Malaysia, and in Canada he was ahead of Marquez, but he had his times disallowed because of a front wing that was below the regulation height. Alex Hill comes in for the final three races to bring a bit of money to the team, and Alonso blows him away. But Alonso also has to his favour, you know, really strong race drives. And the one that everyone sort of points out is Suzuka, where he beat Olivier Panis's BAR, both Arrows, and Heinz Harald Frentzen's Prost. And he finished 11th at Suzuka. Just a really strong drive that people at the time may not have noticed, but just summed up Alonso's, you know, relentless pursuit of any position available that you still see now, driving in some machines that aren't quite at the forefront, scrapping for any position. It doesn't matter what it is.
Kev?
I'm just going to kind of argue against myself, really, to agree with James, but Alonso's entire career really is about being he's one of those rare drivers that can make a car be a level higher than it actually is. And I don't mean it can go faster than it can, because that's impossible, but, you know, in the worst car in the field, he managed to get it into the midfield. When he was at McLaren, they had a midfield car, he dragged it into the points. When he was at Ferrari, it should have been a podium finisher, and he managed to almost win a couple of world championships with it. And so thank goodness for everyone else that he was never in a dominant F1 car. You know, Alonso never had a Red Bull that Vettel had, or the Mercedes that Lewis Hamilton had. And that's really the difference between, you know, him having two world championships, Lewis having seven, and as we talk now, and Sebastian Vettel having four. I think he's absolutely right up there. I think I'd have him ahead of Vettel in terms of his career relentless performance. I completely agree with everything that James has said. I just think it, if we're just looking through the sort of the Minardi magnifying glass, if you like, it comes down to the weighting of Melbourne. And probably if I was making this, if I'd been writing this list, I probably would have had Alonso at number two as well. But as I'm being the devil's advocate person, I keep thinking about Australia 2002. So Webber at second and Alonso third. But if you're doing a list of the best drivers who'd ever sat in a Minardi, then Alonso's number one, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, let's get on to number one then. A name synonymous with the team, Pierluigi Martini, started 92 times for Minardi, scored 16 points, best finish fourth. He would start second on the grid. He was a front row starter at 1990 in Phoenix. And when we talked to him for a 2006 Autosports piece, a series that we called the Master's Degree, not short of any confidence or assessment of his own standing, he said, after 20 years, I'm the driver that drove for Minardi. Nobody remembers Alonso or Fisichella. Everyone remembers Martini. So a few people remember a chap called Alonso. Not sure. Short of a bit of confidence there, but number one on your list, James.
I mean, this is probably the only list that we'll ever make where Pierluigi Martini comes top, but there is just no question about it. By every metric, he's the most important driver in Minardi's history, because, you know, you mentioned how many starts he had. He had three different spells with the team. He was its original F1 driver in 1985, where the car was just absolutely hopeless. We talked before about Nannini's poor reliability record, terrible in 1985 as well. When he comes back to F1 after a spell in Formula 3000, which he kind of needed to rebuild his career, frankly, we mentioned earlier Luis Perez Sala, he comfortably had the measure of him, and pretty much every teammate that he had at Minardi, he was the stronger driver. He's also helped by the fact that, you know, he drove for Minardi at the point when it was at its most competitive, so he was able to get that front row start in Phoenix. He also led its only ever race lap at Estoril in 1989, which sort of roughly coincided with Nigel Mansell deciding to reverse in the pit lane. So that was kind of hidden from the broadcasts at the time, as everyone was watching Mansell, and this piece of history was being ignored. But he has just so many glittering moments in qualifying and strong race drives. I mean, he scores its first ever point in Detroit 1988. The thing that I really wanted to talk about was the end of the 1989 season, where he'd had to miss Suzuka due to rib pain. This came after some really strong qualifying results, where he was only behind the McLarens and the Ferraris. But he comes back after missing a race, and he's third in Australia, where Sala doesn't even qualify. what a fantastic indictment that is of, you know, just the figurehead Martini was for the team. Frequent point scorer throughout the, you know, his time there when the opportunities were there. He has a season with Scuderia Italia in 92, comes back towards the end of 93 where he has the better of Fittipaldi and Gounon in qualifying. Has the better of Michele Alboreto in 94 when an admittedly sort of flagging Alboreto is sort of coming towards the end of his F1 career. And then matches Badua in 95 before sort of stepping out as Lamy comes in. There was no question of who was going to top this list, frankly.
Kev?
Yeah, I've got to agree. It's amazing how we've said this before, don't we? You say almost every episode, it feels like. I have to find one where there's not an obvious number one, won't we? If I was to go looking for a list where there's not an obvious number one. But yeah, I mean, more starts. Yeah, and I think I'm looking up that it was of the 38 points, I think it was, that Minardi scored in F1, Martini accounts for 16 of them, so almost half. When you're watching Formula 1 in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, like he was someone to look out for. Like, you would look for him in qualifying. Like, he was routinely in the top 10. You know, if it was the point scoring system that we have now, he would have scored a lot more points for Minardi as well, and a lot of them on merit. Okay, so I know that there were times where the tyres came into play and that helped him qualify higher than the car could race, but you still got to do the lap time. Yeah, so, I mean, he spent a large part of his career there, more starts from Minardi than anyone else, the first driver. It's impossible, really, to put anyone else in at this. So, it's almost like, we're doing a top 10 Minardi F1 drives. Who are we doing after we've got Martini in at one? It's almost that kind of thing. So
that was very much the approach, was Martini is unquestionably number one. Who fills the remaining nine?
Yeah, I mean, another way of looking at it is, what do you think of when you think of these drivers? Most of these drivers, there's another image that comes to mind. But with Martini, it just is a Minardi, isn't it? It's a Minardi in 89 or 90 up fighting with... Or chasing desperately the Ferraris and McLarens and the big boys, really, because Minardi were never that. But that's the closest they got to consistently being a thorn in the side of the big guns. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Martini's Mr. Minardi, isn't he? So I think that's perfect.
Brilliant. Well, I hope you've enjoyed another one of our top 10 lists. Thank you very much for listening to the Autosport podcast. Make sure you subscribe to the channel. And if you haven't left any feedback yet on the usual places like Apple Podcasts on your phone or your iTunes, then you can do that. You can leave a little star rating and a few words about why you listen to the Autosport podcast, maybe for these special series or the other stuff that we do as well. Brilliant. Well, make sure you stay tuned.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
And for another top 10 list coming very soon in a week's time. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you on the next one.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
The is it morning yet deal, how about now or now? Because morning time is McDonald's breakfast time, and that's the best time of all the times.
Wake up with a little splash of sweetness. Get any size iced coffee from caramel to hazelnut to French vanilla for just 99¢ until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Sports Social Podcast Network.